So I was given the task of talking about recent trends in STD public health activities and services, but people kept on saying, but Charlotte, you know, what we really want to know is what would it take to bring the incidence of STDs down? And, you know, and how much would it cost? I mean, that's what we really need to have a sense of. And so that way we can develop a strategic plan that isn't just piecemeal, well, we'll have a little bit of this and a little bit of that and cobble everything together. And then the thought is, if we know what is needed, then perhaps together we can more effectively move towards this goal. So how much would it cost? Well, it depends. I mean, and this is something that I want to give an illustrative example. So this is a slide that's looking at chlamydia and gonorrhea test costs. What I want to highlight is this multiple antigen amplified probe. That means a nucleic acid amplification test that is for both gonorrhea and chlamydia at the same time. Well, through CMS, which is the center that supports Medicaid and Medicare, the test would be reimbursed at a cost of $98. And so that's for both chlamydia and gonorrhea, and most of the populations that Medicaid is serving, it would be appropriate to target screening of young women for both chlamydia and gonorrhea. Well, here in Chicago, they've negotiated, and this is a cost figure courtesy of Will Wong, the public health laboratory is doing the same test for $13.50. And so, and this figure of $13.50 is more what is the cost that are used in estimates about the cost effectiveness of chlamydia screening in the United States amongst young women. And so, if it's compared to $13.50, where it's cost effective to screen women at a prevalence of, say, you know, 3 to 5%, is it going to be cost effective to screen women when the test is costing $98? So, again, thinking, you know, we have to think about all of these different things. When it comes to how much resources would we need. So what do these different test costs mean? So in the United States, there's about 3.3 million young women who are insured through Medicaid. And I just want to remind you that their insurance is paid through federal dollars. So this is, you know, our dollars based on our taxes. If 50% of women are screened for chlamydia and gonorrhea with a nucleic acid amplification test, at current CMS reimbursement rates, it's going to cost us $161 million per year. And that's for only screening about half of the women. And so, and I just want to make a note that that's the same amount of money as the entire budget of the Division of STD Prevention. So to give it some sort of perspective, and I'll be talking about that a little bit later. And we know from various sources that about 50% of women in Medicaid are screened. So this is a realistic estimate. So what would it cost if we screened the same number of women, the same 50% of women with a $13.50 test, it would be $22 million a year, and which would be a better use of our federal resources? I think most of us can have an idea of what would be a better use of our dollars. And I think one of the things to also keep in mind is that the reimbursement rates for federal plans is very similar to what it costs at a managed care organization. So there may be some differences, but overall it's costing closer to the $98 for a chlamydia and gonorrhea test than the $13.50. And all of our resources are tied up in our private insurance as well. We pay for the premiums through our employers and such, so it's not a trivial matter. So this slide is looking at the national health expenditures between 1960, when I was just a little one, and 2003, and it's what percent of the gross domestic product. So in 1960, it was about 5%, while in 2003, it was almost 15%. Now, this slide is a slide that I borrowed from Julie Gerberding, and it's from a talk that she gave at Emory University in February about health services transformation, and it's part of a lecture series. And she asked the question, and it's something that John Douglas also asked during his talk, why isn't the United States the country that spends the most on health the healthiest nation? And so one of the things is we have very expensive care, and I just talked about about 16% currently of our annual gross domestic product, or about $6,400 per person. You can see how that's happening. If we're paying $98 for a chlamydia and gonorrhea test, then that's, you know, that's perhaps not the most efficient use of our resources. In addition, there is disparate access to care. There's 47 million Americans who are uninsured, or about 15% of the population. And as John Douglas discussed earlier this morning, the persons who are at greatest risk for STDs are disproportionately uninsured. So how are we going to cover their expenses? We can't always just go and look for, looking for other people to pay for it, because there's no one else to pay for these services. In addition, the quality of care in the United States is uneven. There's over and underutilization of services. Something that John Douglas also mentioned earlier this morning was that only about 50% of women in managed care settings are being screened for chlamydia, and it's about 30%, 35% in private care settings. So there's an underutilization of services, and chlamydia is one of the top four underutilized preventive health services in the United States. So now to maybe what people maybe were more expecting I would talk about. So what kind of resources are there in the division of STD? So this slide is looking at the allocation between 1973 and 2007. The yellow line is the absolute number of dollars, the unadjusted for inflation dollars. So you see it's been increasing steadily between 1973 and 2001. The pink line is actually adjusted for inflation, and you see that sort of moderates that line. And probably, problems with the control. It's increasing rates of accidents. Watch out with my arrow. So, and the blue line is looking at funding per 200 million U.S. population adjusted for inflation of 2007 U.S. dollars. And I think I looked on the census site last night and saw that there is approximately every 13 seconds a new person in the United States. And so our population has been expanding, so we need to think about our resources in a time where we're having an increasing population. And if you look at the blue line, the resources have been, you know, if you look at the long period, they're, you know, somewhat stable, plus or minus 30%. But they have been decreasing since 2001, with about a 20% decrease from 2001 to 2007. So this slide is looking at the Division of STD Prevention's frontline staff between 1986 and 2006. And until yesterday, they were called field staff. But I think after Julie Gerberding commented that we really need to be thinking about these are persons at the front line. And I appreciate that as a person who came from the field before. So the kind of peak number of staff that were available was in 1991 with 511. And then in 1993, there was an edict that came down of a mandatory cut of staff to a target of 225 persons. So cutting the staff almost more than in half. And so you can see there was a decline in staffing over time as a result kind of attrition and people moving into headquarters and such, which means Atlanta. And then in 1999, the maximum number of staff that were that CDC could have was increased to about 250 as a result of additional resources going towards syphilis elimination. But overall, there's been a substantial decline in the staff available on the front line to do many public health services. So again, this is a slide that John Douglas showed this morning. It's looking at the CDC program funding from 2001 to 2006 and giving some sort of perspective of where does STD fit into that. So if we look at programs who've had more funding, we see things like Strategic National Stockpile. The funding's increased by almost 900% compared to down to Vaccines for Children, which has had an 84% increase. There are several programs on this slide as examples of stable funding, so that does exist. And then there also then are programs with less funding. So the STD program between the years of 2001 and 2006 had about a 15% absolute, reduction in available resources when you adjust for inflation. So then I'm going to talk about other services that have been changing over time. The IOM report, The Hidden Epidemic, which was published in 1997, described STD clinics as a safety net of STD care. And however, there have been increasing barriers to access to STD clinics, and this has been a result of clinic closures. There have been clinics that have been closing since 1995 with closure in, I think, there's lots of closures in L.A. in 1995, closures in Washington, D.C., and then recently that is still going on. Utah's had a couple of clinics that have closed in this year, Rhode Island. California's had several clinics closed, St. Louis, Chicago in October. So this is a reality. We have less places for people to provide the safety net. In addition, there are clinics that have been turning patients away. There's an outbreak of syphilis in Houston right now, and patients are being turned away from their STD clinic at this time. In the past, there have been some turnaways in New York City and San Francisco. And one of the ways that some programs have dealt with this is by changing the way they offer services, by offering perhaps more limited services to people who are asymptomatic. And there's examples of this being presented here at the conference, and John Douglas discussed some of those in New York City and Denver and such. In addition, many programs have been faced with, well, how can I, you know, make up the shortfall so they might increase fees? And the Denver STD program had a really elegant study that showed that as they increase fees in the Denver on the Metro STD clinic, that the proportion of patients, the number of patients who came to the clinic dropped dramatically, as did the number of diagnoses in the whole entire city. So when there weren't the services available in the STD clinic, it's not like they were all made up for in the private sector or in other settings. So then there's also problems of long waits and decreased hours of service. So this slide is actually based on a poster that's presented downstairs. And one of the reasons I wanted to look at STD clinics have disproportionately served men, and there's a report, a paper that was published by Brackbill in 1998 that also suggests that STD clinics are where most people receive care for gonorrhea, was the single most important site for that. And so I was wondering about if we're looking at, you know, we know that there's decreasing STD clinics, how might this be impacting our morbidity and how we look at things? So this slide's looking at gonorrhea amongst men, reported cases of men 15 to 29 years of age by race, ethnicity, and type of clinic. When you say type of clinic, it really means STD clinic or non-STD clinic. It doesn't mean STD clinic or private. It's just STD clinic or non-STD clinic. So the orange line, I'm reluctant to use my arrow since the slide might switch, but the orange there is the number of infections in young men that were, and young black men that were diagnosed in the STD clinic, in an STD clinic setting between 1997 and 2006, and there's a 31% decrease. If we look at non-STD, oops, yeah, I was afraid of. If we look at non-STD clinic settings, there is an increase overall of 61% of the number of cases diagnosed. Well, how does that compare with whites? If you look at the dark blue line, you see that whites in STD clinic actually had a 16% increase in the number of infections that were diagnosed, and whites also had a much larger increase in the number of infections diagnosed in non-STD clinic settings. And so one of the questions is part of the decrease in disparities that we're seeing between African Americans and whites, is it due to real changes in the burden of infection in these different populations, or could it be due to changes in access to care? So there's shrinking resources and increasing costs. So how do we prioritize things? And I think some of the ways that many of us think about that is based on social justice, human suffering, and cost burden. And why I got into public health was for reasons of social justice and human suffering. And now that I'm working in health services research and evaluation, I'm thinking about cost burden a lot more, and it's become much more salient to me. So social justice. So we're thinking about reducing disparities in STDs and their access. adverse outcomes. So I think right now we're really at sort of a time where there's a tremendous opportunity for change, where we can address the longstanding disparities between persons of colors and white. And there's an opportunity for community mobilization to increase advocacy for resources in priority settings. And I think it was so exciting to hear from Loretta Ross yesterday about Sister Song. Here's this opportunity for advocacy, and you know, and is coming from the community that's affected. Another opportunity for advocacy is through community health centers, and these are both partnerships. They're ways that we can create partnerships and community mobilization. And one kind of core fundamental point of a community health center is they're governed by a community board. So 51% of their board at least has to be members of the health center patients. So they're really thinking about how they're energizing and lobbying for resources. So thinking about sort of the context of human suffering. So I think one of the things we're concerned about in the division is a priority is reducing STD-related infertility. John Douglas showed this slide this morning also, and is looking at trends in positivity in 10 of the Health and Human Service regions. And you see that it's been flat the last several years. And we've been putting a lot of resources into screening. We've been showing that there's, you know, increasing screening amongst women. But the question is it right, reaching the right women? And this is a slide that I saw on Sunday during this. We had this meeting called Program Science, and it was Jamie Blanchard gave it to me, and it's like become one of my favorite slides. So this slide is looking at the age-adjusted incidence rate of reported chlamydia cases in by Manitoba postal area, and is the bars are 1991 and the line is 1998. And one of the things that they saw in Manitoba, they began this incredibly comprehensive screening program where they, you know, were offering tests to a lot of people. It included partner services. They had DIS equivalents doing partner management. And overall, in the community, they saw a decrease and then a leveling off, similar to what we've seen in the United States. And they went and looked at their data, and they looked at where is the incidence, where was the biggest change in incidence, and it was in the was in this middle area. These areas with lower prevalence of infection is where they saw a decline, and yet in the communities with very high prevalence of infection, there was really very little change in incidence between 1991 and 1998. And that suggests that they weren't reaching the target of people at highest risk, and if you're not reaching those persons, then you're not going to have an impact on the overall prevalence of an infection in the United States. So do we need to expand? So this raises a question. Do we need to expand into different settings for chlamydia screening to make a difference? How can we reach young women with the highest rates of infection who are disproportionately lower socioeconomic status, uninsured or underinsured, and racial and ethnic minorities? And there's potential partners for us, and these include Medicaid, community health centers, and corrections. However, our potential partners do not have deep pockets. So we're talking about that Medicaid, I gave an example as maybe they're spending up to $165 million on chlamydia screening now. That would be good if they were doing more. Community health centers, 35% have Medicaid patients and 40% have no insurance. And, you know, many people assume that Medicaid is supposed to be the safety net, but it clearly says on the Medicaid website it does not provide insurance for all poor people in the United States. So there's a big gap. In addition, while corrections people in corrections have a guaranteed constitutional right to health care, it's not preventive care. And so what we're thinking about is preventive care. So they're not necessarily, under the current system, great places to go and look for resources. So there's been a lot of talk about well, you need to partner with managed care in the private sector. And indeed, these are really important partners, and it's one of the ways that we can leverage other people's money. John Douglas called it the OPM. However, and they do provide services to a large proportion of young people. However, do their services target the persons we want to reach to really make a difference? So then the next thing I want to talk about a little bit is the economic burden and how can we reduce STD-related costs. Now, this slide is a slide based on, adapted from work by several people in the Health Services Research Branch at CDC, and it has been updated to $2007, where the estimated annual incidence cost of STDs is $15.3 billion. And one of the things I want to highlight here is that most of this burden is with viral STDs, and yet our STD programs often focus on the bacterial. So HIV is about 54% of the burden. HPV is 34%. HSV is 6%. Chlamydia is 4%. Trich and gonorrhea are both about 1%. And syphilis is actually 0.1%. I actually had to kind of fudge it so it would show up on the slide at all, of the burden. So if we focus on the economic burden, even if we have a transformed health system, we'll still not be able to do it all. We'll still have to find ways to make priorities and impact the economic burden. So I think one of the things that kind of the potential solutions is through integration of services, and that's a really key thing. It's the same populations that are disproportionately impacted by all STDs, whether it's HIV, herpes, chlamydia, or gonorrhea. And I think one of the things that we're moving to, even though I'm an anthropologist and hard in some ways, I think that coming to the realization that the majority of populations with high rates of disease have similar behaviors as populations with lower rates. So there isn't simply a behavioral intervention that might make a difference. What we really need is access to quality, non-judgmental services. So how much would it cost to have quality, accessible care? Again, that depends. And I think some of it depends on how frustrated we are with the current healthcare system. And I think one of the things I found very powerful yesterday during both Loretta Ross's presentation and Julie Gerberding's is the experience they had, the anger they had about certain situations and how they used that to harness in a productive way and think about how they can make productive changes and have concrete outcomes. I think it also depends on how we transform our health system as we move into a new administration. And I think it also depends on the vision we have for becoming the healthiest nation. And So I'm going to close with this, and this is a slide from Julie Gerberding again in this lecture that she gave in February. And what she did is she took a speech of John F. Kennedy where he's talking about launching a man to the moon, and she changed it to what if I believe this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of becoming a healthiest nation and leading the way so that every nation on earth can share in this endeavor. No single human project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important in the long-range expansion of human development and equity, and none will be so difficult or expensive to accomplish. And so I think that we can't just have little Band-Aids. We have to think big. So thank you.